High shelf toppled forward, and had Tolliver not shouted, Lean would have been crushed beneath it. Despite the horror that kept their hearts pounding, and in spite of the battle raging in the streets and across the hills and upon the river, a lightness had touched this small band who had such faith in the mission they'd undertaken. That lightness had not touched Deimos's heart, though. His thoughts were only on the crown in its crate, in its harsh cloth sack, in its silken bag. On what that crudely wrought bejeweled metal meant for his future. When they'd packed the most vital volumes, things that could never be found elsewhere, Samny still insisted on staying with the rest of the archives. Mirren tried to dissuade her, but the woman would not be moved. The books in this vast chamber had not only been her trust, they'd been her life, and she would not leave them.
Come back to me when it's over, Samny said, touching Princess Mirren's face again the way a mother might. Come back to me when you are queen, and we will restore the archives together.
I shall, Mirren said, nodding. I swear it. The dread in Deimos's chest blossomed then, spread through him so completely it nearly stopped his heart. He waited, though, until they were all laden with crates and had said hasty farewells to Samny, who did not bother to close the door of the archives behind them as they began to hurry back along the wide, cracked, glass-strewn corridor. The floor shook, and the gap in the floor had grown larger, but they managed to pass the crates across, one to the other. Yarn hurled Tolliver across the gap, and Deimos jumped last of all, landing surely this time. Lightning struck just behind them, stabbing through the window as if aiming for it, and the stone floor blackened and buckled into a smoking ruin. The shaking underfoot had seemed to calm a bit, but Deimos shouted at them not to tarry. The others might think the rumble had abated, but to him it seemed as if the instability had only gone deeper underground, far beneath the hills, and that frightened him even more. He wondered for a moment if it were possible for the entire world to split apart. The others had gone ahead, reached the curving stairs, and Deimos caught up to Mirren. Keep moving, he said. I was waiting. A shout cut off her reply. Deimos and Mirren were on the stairs, but Tolliver and the three soldiers had reached the bottom just as a cluster of city guards had rushed into the space that awaited them. Tall windows beside the stairs let the rain in, and Deimos had to blink the drops away to see the small figure that led those guards. Young Kira, whom they'd spared. It seemed she'd made her choice about who ought to be queen tomorrow, and Mirren had not been her answer. Princess, one of the guards shouted. Order these treasonous pigs to stand down, or—
I order you to stand down, Mirren replied. In the absence of my sister, I command you.
A dozen members of the city guard were there, all fully grown save for the girl. But it was she who shouted indictments against the princess, rousing the others to approach with swords raised. Slowly the sailors put their crates down. Alita had always been quiet, adept as a sailor, skilled as a warrior, leaned and muscled and brutal without being cruel. It was she now who stepped forward and almost nonchalantly killed the guard nearest to her. And then swords clashed, boots crashed into chests and kicked at knees. Two city guards cornered Lean and cut her down, only for Yarn to slay both of them with a ferocity Deimos had never seen in the man. Tolliver blocked a sword with the crate in his arms, and it burst asunder, sending him sprawling to collect the items he'd lost even as a guard pursued him. Deimos reached the guard first, dropping his wooden crate and drawing his sword before the box hit the floor. Even as he cut the guard down, even as he saw Alita drive her sword through Kira's skull, Deimos felt the way the whole palace seemed to settle and quiet, like a ship becalmed upon a glass sea. Even the rain lessened, even the wind died outside, and yet he knew.
Deimos grabbed Tolliver by the arm, dragging the boy with him as he turned toward Mirren and shouted her name, cried out for all of them to take shelter. But there was no shelter from the hill beneath them. Like an ancient beast waking, the world itself shrugged and the palace cracked down to its cellars. The outer wall collapsed as Deimos hurled Tolliver toward Mirren. He saw a part of the ceiling crash down on Yarn with a sound that would echo in his mind even into his own grave, which was almost certainly not far off. And then something struck him in the head, and Deimos felt weightless a moment before the world went dark. Deimos heard his name, blinked his eyes, groaned as Tolliver and Alita shifted a fragment of the marble stairs off his chest. The architecture had saved him, the curve of the stone preventing it from crushing him. Blood matted his hair and felt warm on his face, but he felt strong enough to help them shove it away. With the ground still trembling, he struggled to his feet in the full force of the storm. No ceiling stopped the wind and rain now, no walls shut it out, and the respite they'd felt earlier was well past them now. He glanced over and saw that the entirety of the corner of the palace that had held the archives of the crown was only a smoking ruin. He spared a thought for loyal Samni, who must surely be dead. Then turned the other way and saw that the corridor from which the guards had come had been sealed off by collapsing masonry. Mirren dragged a crate over toward the others. She'd recovered three in total. Whatever portions of the history of Quandus had been in the others had been buried. For now. Perhaps forever if the world did not stop shaking. He knew then that she had been right. "The crown," he said as he rushed to her. His princess tapped one crate and nodded. That, at least, was safe. The way behind and the way ahead were both blocked, but the outer wall of the palace had collapsed entirely. Through the storm, Deimos could see other buildings in ruin down the hill, including on Calistrate Hill and Hartshorn Hill, where familiar towers no longer marked the horizon. Above them, the Bone Spire was no more. But the Blood Spire remained, defiantly spearing the sky. Together they picked their way across the rubble, Deimos, Mirren, Tolliver, and Alita, carrying what remained of Quandus in their arms, saving what they could, knowing it might not matter, knowing they might be carrying the crown to a doomed kingdom.
"I don't want to lose you so soon after finding you again," Darius said.
"You're not losing me,"
Blaine said, but she could not be sure. She had never seen anyone looking so sick, yet he was also brimming with the strange energy that magic brought, pained and wretched, strong and aware. Each step up Temple Hill toward the Temple of Four at its top brought tears of pain to his eyes. "You're bleeding," Darius said at his side. She held his arm and helped him walk.
"Everyone bleeds," Blaine said. "It's weakness leaving the body. It will make me stronger."
Bajamin marched around them. Some already bore wounds that would scar, providing them physical evidence of this tragic, triumphant day. Many more who had come with Darian now lay dead. But she knew that each death was earned, and every one of them prayed to Lemuria that every Bajamin lost today would make the world a better place for those left behind. Perhaps Blaine might make that so. From above, sounds of war rolled down from the main Temple of Four up on the hill. Snow was melting beneath the constant rains, and light still sparked and arced above the temple, from the wide courtyard hidden from sight by the rise in the slope and the temple's walls. One of the towers had cracked, a great wall slumping down to the ground and landing with an impact that had shaken the hill. Fires raged, walls shook, buildings farther down the hill shook themselves to pieces with the violence of what was happening above and out of sight. They all knew what it was. Fila, their queen, using whatever magic she had drawn or stolen from the Four to make this land her own.
Magic is fighting in me, sister, Blaine said, but I'll win.
He sounded sad, but his voice was strong, emerging from a face stained with wet and drying blood. His eyes glimmered with terror and delight. Even so, she saw the boy she had known and loved, and feared the man he had become. Good. Fight back, she said. She kept hold of Blaine's arm and walked with him, at once just a brother and a sister in the midst of this battle for Qandis's greatest city, but also the very epicenter of that battle. For while they were being driven to a final confrontation just ahead of them, without them, there would be no fight. And although Fila might not know it, she and Blaine were the focus of how the world would look tomorrow. It was a great weight of responsibility that weighed heavy on Daria's shoulders, but she had borne such weight before, and Blaine had been preparing for such a burden his entire life. For our people, he said. For the Bajuman. We fight for even more, Daria said. I've seen what you can do, brother, and though I don't understand it, I love you all the more for it. We were born slaves. We each found our own way up from bondage. Now we fight not just for ourselves or our people, but for the whole kingdom. A great booming detonation punched through the air, shaking the ground, smashing windows, and startling a flock of birds aloft. Daria felt the thump in her chest and gut. Ahead and above, the top section of the damaged tower was crumbling and falling, disintegrating as it fell and scattering debris across a wide area. Stone blocks, shrapnel, and dust showered down around them, and her forces ducked for cover. As the rumbles of destruction went on, Daria looked around at the devastation. Blaine was caked in wet dust, wide-eyed and staring right at her. You're our only chance, Daria said, snapping him out of his shock. Come on. I don't think we have much time. They hurried uphill. Lieutenant Skin had led her troops at the fringes of their advance, closing on the temple from two directions in a pincer movement. Daria's own troops had moved upward in six lines, winnowing between buildings, confronting resistance wherever they found it, and dispatching it quickly and efficiently. The Bajuman had poured around them, without discipline and many of them carrying no real weapons. Sharpened stakes, digging tools, kitchen knives, blocks of wood. They took whatever they could find, hundreds of them, surging up the hillside like an avenging tide. They had swept everything before them, and now they were closing on the Temple of Four. The gates were open. No one guarded them, but several bodies were splayed against the wall. Daria didn't hesitate and signaled that they should advance. There was little time for caution. The air was alight with terrible change, and if magic had a smell, she could smell it in the rain. If magic had a taste, it settled on her tongue. She and Blaine remained close together. She carried a deep pain, and had ever since they had been reunited on the Nyadin only hours before. It wasn't physical, but rather a pang of regret and nostalgia, and many times she'd simply wanted to stop and stare at the man he had become, remember their childhood, and try to recreate the love that had been between them. But aside from the precarious situation they were in, she had been too long out of Blaine's life, and now wasn't the time to expect him to simply move past that. She wasn't sure if that was even possible at this point, and she worried there might never be time now. They passed through the main gates and into the outer compound of the Temple of Four. Several dead priests lay scattered across the area, and Daria recognized sword wounds in their chests and stomachs. Some of them were novices. Blaine ran to them, examined them briefly, and then moved on. Skin's forces approached from two different directions.
The outer parts of the temple are deserted. Other than the dead, that is, she said.
Daria nodded. No one needed to say where to go next.
She'll have set guards, the sailor Lorizzo said.
Maybe, Daria said. But that's why we are armed. Besides, it sounds like she's still fighting a battle in there, and I don't know if she'll be in a position to counter our rush. Things are moving quickly, and we must too. Lieutenant, you force through the courtyard to the north. We'll approach from the east.
And us? A Bajuman asked.
He had a cut across his nose and carried a city guard's sword. He still looked at Daria's feet as he spoke, but she had hope he would find his pride today, if he survived. She hoped they all would.
Tell the Bajuman to charge, Daria said.
I hate to be blunt, but you're not soldiers and you don't know formations and tactics. But you do have passion, and if you can marshal it, that will be your greatest weapon.
No, the man said.
He looked at Blaine, and although what he saw must have shocked him, he grinned.
Our greatest weapon is revenge.
The rebel forces charged. From the outer compound, they entered the temple buildings, and Daria ensured that she stayed close to Blaine. She'd seen how he could defend himself in a terrible, shocking way, but there was also a vulnerability apparent in her brother, almost an innocence. He knew what he carried, and he craved more, but at the same time it was crushing him. While they fought this battle outside, his conflict raged within. She wanted to be there whether he lost or won. They surged through the buildings, meeting little resistance. She heard sounds of combat from elsewhere, but she was confident that her troops were holding their own against whatever city guards remained active in the temple. They moved ever forward. They found more dead priests. It looked as though some of them had been executed, their bodies in positions of repose, while their decapitated heads were kicked into a corner. A few had been killed while resisting, but Daria found their death sad however they had died. Murdered for beliefs, and for not supporting their new mad monarch. As they drew closer to the vast inner courtyard, Blaine bolted ahead. Cursing, Daria raced to catch up with him, and so it was they were among the first to break cover and emerge onto the foursquare, where Fila and her forces were waiting for them. The queen stood at the center of the courtyard, her clothing streaked with blood, the air around her simmering with heat haze even though the rain still fell. To her right side crouched Persantigar. The big old priest Daria had met once or twice before, at grand social occasions. He looked diminished now, cowering down like a dog before a brutal master. He saw them enter the courtyard and his slack-jawed, wide-eyed expression did not change. Daria saw no hope in his eyes, only a vacant, calm acceptance. Bodies lay all around. But the one that caught Daria's attention was dressed in religious finery, blood spattered and broken, and the air around it crackled with weak energy, arcs of white light leaping between raindrops and steaming the blended water and blood on the ground. Apex Euphraxia was dead. The ground around Fila was cracked. The energy in the air was cloying, heavy. The queen did not even have to tell her soldiers to attack. As they came, Daria counted 4 silent and 6 city guards, including Commander Curtness, carrying injuries, yet loyal to his queen to the last. Because this was their last stand, surely. There was no way these few ragged defenders could triumph, even though 4 silent stood among them. Was there? Daria ran with Blaine, but both of them slowed as they saw the silent assassin who came for them. She was a tall warrior, bald-headed, tattooed, and Daria knew of her. Careful, she said to Blaine. This is Shom, deadliest of them all. Blaine smiled, and something about that smile made Shom hesitate. The assassin paused 30 feet away and then approached more slowly, warily. Admiral, someone shouted, and as Daria turned and ducked, she cursed her momentary lack of alertness. A blade whispered by just above her head,
and she knew that a second later it would have taken her head. She stabbed out with her own sword, kicking out the legs of the city guard attacking her, and dropping him on his back. The man fell forward and she followed him down, pinning him to the ground. He shouted and screamed, spitting blood at her as he struggled. But she paid his histrionics no mind. Her sword's tip scraped against stone as he tried to pull away. She shifted her weight and twisted the sword. The cracking of bones, the flowing of darker blood, and the life went from the man's eyes. Standing and whirling to take on a new attacker, instead Daria's eyes were drawn to the center of the courtyard, where Philo watched the attack with a curious calmness. The ground around her had been turned and disturbed, paving stones cracked and pointing skyward with sharp fingers. Yet the piece of courtyard she stood on remained solid and untouched. There was still snow on her shoulders. Her eyes glimmered as if from a fire inside. She looked wrong, as if the angle of her limbs was altered, the weight of her unsettled. Daria caught her eye, and Queen Phila smiled. She doesn't think we have a chance, Daria thought. Which means she doesn't know about Blaine. Out of the corner of her eye, Daria saw Shom creeping toward them, like a predator unwilling to frighten off her skittish prey. Blaine stood and waited, and even the rain seemed to avoid him, though it poured down on the assassin. Across the courtyard, dozens of Bajamin charged the remaining city guard defenders. They entered into battle, the more experienced soldiers keeping their composure, issuing calm and careful death to the Bajamin hordes. Many fell, but there were more to take their place, and more after that, revenge driving them on. At the same time, Lieutenant Skin and her soldiers finally stormed into the courtyard, archers unleashing a hail of arrows at the queen. With a wave of Phila's hand, they burst into flame and disintegrated in the air around her. Shom charged at that moment, sprinting toward Blaine with her sword poised to strike. Daria stepped in front of her brother, her own sword drawn. She stood no chance against the captain of the Silent, but she would not let Blaine die so easily. Her brother must have felt the same way about her chances. A gust of wind swept her up like an ocean wave and brushed her aside, leaving the path between Shom and Blaine open. Blaine raised his hands, and the greatest of the Silent ignited in a moving inferno, clothing ablaze, face melting, limbs blackening and cracking. Still, Shom swung her sword, trying to kill him. Somehow she had sensed the threat in him, and now here it was. She fell at Blaine's feet, her body bursting into cinders. The fire burned so brightly around her remains that even the driving rain could not put it out. The whole time, Shom made no noise. The same could not be said for Phila, as the queen screamed in rage. Where Shom had died, the ground exploded upward in a hail of shattered stone and fire, enveloping the dead warrior and blasting her burning remains skyward in a boiling geyser. Parts of her fell back to the ground. Other parts were smashed and burned to nothing. Phila screamed again. Where Skin and her soldiers had entered the courtyard, the whole section of wall crumbled as if crushed down by a heavy, invisible weight from above. Several soldiers went down beneath the falling stone, and others tripped and slipped, a few falling victim to two Silent who rushed into their midst, taking advantage of the confusion. "My time is now," the queen shouted. Beside her, old Persantiger started crawling away. Blaine went to his knees and lowered his head, and for a moment Daria thought he'd been wounded. And when she heard his whisper, she understood. "I am Keech Tal." He was preparing himself. And she stepped back and away, giving her brother space and praying to Lemuria, the god she knew, that he could defeat this bearer of magic from the gods she did not. It was as if a heavy fist punched her directly in the face, Blinded, stunned, Daria fell back and dropped her sword. Up and down seemed to lose meaning, and while the ground pounded at her back with tremor after tremor, it might have been her body being slammed against a vibrating stone ceiling or a wall. The breath was snatched from her body. Her lungs and chest burned. Her vision was pale, little more than a shimmering miasma with bursts of bright fire blooming across it. And she felt pulses of heat singeing her hair, stretching her skin. Struggling to make sense of what had happened, she brought her hands in and pressed them to her face, terrified at what she might find. Eyes, nose, mouth. Some blood, but not too much damage. Cupping her hands over her nose, she took in several slow breaths, then sat up and looked around. The wide four-square was almost unrecognizable. The ground had been churned and stirred, and several pools of smoking molten rock glowed, spat, and steamed as rain hit them. Around their edges were the torn remnants of dead people, flesh blackened and still burning in places with a low purple light. Another tower was on the verge of tumbling, great blocks and tiles falling away and their impacts adding to the cacophony. Some survivors remained. They pulled themselves from the rubble, battered and bloodied and looking around in an effort to make out what had happened. Unscathed, Blaine was walking through the destruction. He seemed more certain than before, stronger than she had ever seen him. And as he approached the center of the courtyard, the place where the ground remained stable and the destruction seemed minimal, Daria went to call after him, to warn him about Fila. But Blaine did not need warning. Queen Fila was across the other side of the square, pulling herself upright against one of the few walls that remained standing. Even from this far away, Daria could make out the blood coating her features, a red mask from which two wild, stunned eyes stared. The air around her flexed and shimmered. Her limbs shook, and when she opened her mouth to scream, she vomited a torrent of black blood. Why would she even want this power if it works to destroy her? Blaine took his place at the center of the four-square. He stood up tall and straight, staring at Fila as if daring her to challenge his place. Fila was trying to rein in her powers. Daria could see the struggle within her, body shaking, limbs shivering as if each was held by a different entity and pulled, shaken, tugged in four different directions. "It's mine," Blaine said. Daria heard that very clearly, and in her heart of hearts she knew that was the end of Blaine, her brother, and the beginning of someone so much worse. "It's mine!" Fila screeched. Blaine raised one hand and pointed at Fila, as if to answer, when with a deep, almost calming sigh, half of the courtyard slumped and then fell into darkness. Blaine went with it. Daria scrambled back toward the tumbled courtyard walls, seeing others doing the same. Though a million tons of rock fell, from the black pit before her came nothing but the echo of Blaine's wretched, furious cry. Chapter 23 Queen Fila felt as if she must be flying. Her legs moved, but her feet had gone numb. The hill heaved beneath her, turning her thoughts back in time to when she was 9 years old, the day she'd watched a horse die in the palace stable, the ancient beast shuddering and huffing as its heart beat out the final hour of its life. Was this then the final hour of Lartha? The final hour in the long history of Quandis, the quick end to the short reign of the Eternal Queen. Had she brought about this moment? No, of course not. The wind gusted at her back and the rain washed her clean. The hill undulated like the high seas beneath her, and she stumbled and rose and staggered and ran, half falling and half flying.
Yes, flying. For what was beyond the power of the gods? Down the hill.
The music in her bones had dimmed, the song of magic somehow distant from her now, and yet the magic itself poured from her. Black blood ran fresh from her eyes. Or perhaps it was merely tears this time. Merely tears at last. A spike of pain jolted her heart and she staggered, shuffled, tripped, and fell tumbling down the hill. Arms and face scraped, she pushed back to her feet. Not flying at all, she thought. And she allowed herself a glance at her boots. She could see them, knew her feet were there, but had only the barest sensation of them. Her left hand, too, seemed almost a ghost of itself, solid and there, where it had always been, but somehow also divorced from her. The fingertips had split and bled, appearing charred as if from flames. She curled her left hand into a fist and held it against her as she began careening down the hill again.
Charin, she thought. I pray you give me your blessing.
But her fingers were scorched, and she could feel a searing at the base of her skull, as if her spine were some kind of explosive fuse, and even now burned and sparked. Charin had forsaken her. Once Fila would have wept, but she was Queen Fila now, and so instead she raged. The four had become five, whether they accepted it or not, Ansalam and Batika, Charin and Daphine. They would have to share their worship with Fila, the Eternal Queen. They would have to share with her the way she had already forced them to share their magic. They would have to share, but not their tombs. She would not share that with them. Fila had no intention of dying. With this magic, she would live forever. She would give Quandus the dedication and beauty and discipline it deserved, make her enemies weep and surrender, and then love her. She knew this in her heart. Even as she fled from the temple, the rain had formed torrents sluicing down the hill and torn, worn footpaths to mud. Her boots slipped and she fell, struck her head on the ground, slid and rolled and crashed into the post of a fence along the trail, ribs cracked. Moments vanished as if erased. One second she lay on the path in the mud, and the next she found herself standing, crying out to Ansalam and Batika, to earth and water. She reached down into the ground and seized control of it, summoned up the dirt and rocks so that it opened and grasped at the fence, dragged it down into a new furrow in the hill, shattered it to splinters, and then buried it. This time the gods did not deny her, and with a wave of her arm and another whispered prayer, she swept all of the sluicing storm water aside. For a moment it felt invigorating, and she shuddered with the pleasure of it. But then the reflexive pain shot through her and she screamed. Pain racked her bones, nausea bent her double, and she vomited black and red. And in the midst of the steaming pile she retched onto the ground were bulbous bits of what she knew must have been pieces of her. Queen Fila told herself they didn't matter, those bits. This was merely metamorphosis, a transformation to godhood. She glanced up and saw the bridge to the palace. Its moorings had cracked. Part of the span had split and fallen away, but a band of it remained. It shook and swayed, but Fila rushed toward it so swiftly that it seemed to her the world had frozen, and only she remained able to move. Her vision dimmed and went to black, and when she blinked, she found herself crossing the rain-slicked spit of stone that still linked hill to hill. 3 feet wide, with a 200-foot drop onto stone and hill and rushing river below, it twisted snake-like as if to evade her step. But somehow she managed. Her heart soared. Her vision went dark again, and when she blinked, she was already on Palace Hill, staggering upward, moving toward home.
Phyla seemingly flowed past fires and smoking craters, and when she lifted her gaze, she saw only a sliver of where the bone spire had stood. The blood spire, though. The blood spire stood tall, stabbing at the sky. It swayed like the tallest of trees in the storm. But it would never fall. Queen Phyla knew that. It was thrust deep into the ground, sunk into the heart of the city. The blood spire's very presence shouted the supremacy of the crown, declared the royal family's claim to the blood of the four, reminded the people what they worshipped, what they served. The crown, Phyla thought, and a brightness filled her. She grinned and felt her lips split further, tasting the sickly black blood. The kings and queens of Qandis had not worn the true crown for 1,000 years or more, preserving its sanctity. That will change after today. Numb, she staggered uphill, still holding her left arm against her side. She glanced at her right arm and saw that it bled. The skin had opened in several places, not sliced but split from inside, and that blackness seeped from the holes. Metamorphosis, she thought again, and she felt jubilation. For a moment she thought of her mother, and wished she could share this moment with her, wished Lysandra might embrace her as she had when Phyla had been a small child. A smile touched her lips, one that the stabbing pain, the searing beneath her skin, the screaming pain of the music in her bones could not erase. She thought of Mirren, a memory floating up in her mind of her little sister laughing, only just having learned to walk, chasing her through their mother's chambers. Mirren, she thought. Mother was dead. She vaguely recalled her part in that, but brushed it away. But her little sister, who had once gazed at her with such perfect, uncomplicated love, Mirren still lived. Phyla wanted to share this jubilation with her. With the wind, she eased the weight of her own body against the earth, helped push herself up the hill. The rain seemed to make way for her, parting like curtains, without Queen Phyla even attempting to command it. The magic hummed and pulsed around her. The song in her bones shrieked. But somehow she heard voices over it, and glanced up to see people in the street. There were warriors wearing navy uniforms, and noblemen with swords, and a brutish woman with a bruised and swollen face and a handful of merchants who pointed and shouted. Queen Phyla expected their worship. Instead, she felt the rage and disgust that emanated from them, saw the loathing on their faces. They moved across broken cobblestones to surround her. A mother cradled a dead boy, his body crushed and limbs broken, beside a row house whose facade had collapsed. A scorched dog dragged a useless limb as it licked the dead child's face. They all screamed for the head of their queen, championed her murder. Phyla staggered to a halt, gasping for ragged, painful breaths. She spat a lungful of black bile onto the broken street. With a sneer, she prayed to the four. With their magic, with their fire and their wind and their power over the stones of the street, Queen Phyla killed every last one of them, even the dog. The effort ripped her flesh further, tore at her insides, and as she marched on toward the palace, more determined than ever, she felt herself slipping into darkness again. She thought of the darkness the Bajamin had fallen into, and shuddered. When she blinked, the queen found herself standing in front of the palace. Fires burned from the windows of the south wing. The gates had collapsed into the ground, and even as she watched, the city trembled and the rubble shifted and separated, and even more of the face of the palace spilled into the gaping hole, tumbling into the caverns below. Queen Phyla heard sobbing somewhere nearby, but it seemed so distant. And once again she felt as if she had slipped into a kind of dream.
The rest of the world existed for her only across the wonderful distance at which sleepers could hold reality. The east wing of the palace had vanished. Only a ruin remained, and it smoked as the rain poured down upon it. The archives of the crown had been there. The history of her family, of the bloodline, of the crown, had been in that chamber, along with 20,000 volumes of science and exploration, and drama and whimsy. This loss pained her somehow even more than the loss of the great relic, the ancient crown itself. For the crown was her future, but the books in the archives were her precious past. She thought of Samney, and the laughing little child Mirren had been, and she thought of wretched Aris and how much his approval had once meant to her. She thought of the mother whose death she had hastened, and this time she couldn't shake it off. Her own mother, whom she had killed. The blackness enveloped her again. When she blinked, she found herself halfway around the gaping hole in the ground, scrambling over the wreckage of what had been the palace gates. The queen blinked again, and the darkness came with pain this time, like a dozen knives in her back and neck and gut. She opened her eyes to find herself on her knees at the bottom of the stairs, inside the gullet of the blood spire. The skin of her arms had split further, her abdomen pulse, pregnant with pain, as the magic clawed at her, woke her. She began to climb, and with each step she felt stronger, the magic lifting her, burning away the frailty of flesh and blood. Her tongue slid out and found the ichor on her ruined lips delicious. Her teeth shifted as she worked her jaw, and she let her tongue press against them. Several were so loose that they tipped from their sockets, and she spat them onto the stairs as she climbed. As she evolved, Queen Fila breathed deeply, feeling the power growing within her. The stairwell bloomed with blue light, not only from the billions of tiny incandescences that floated in the air, but from the glow now pulsing in the punctures and splits in her skin. She blinked, and the blackness swam in. Blinked, and it swam out, and she found herself not climbing the hundreds of steps up the throat of the blood spire, but running them, sprinting them effortlessly, as if muscle no longer mattered, as if breath no longer mattered. To her they did not. The queen opened her mouth, and the song of her bones burst forth. She made no effort to summon that noise or put voice to it. No, this was the voice of the magic suffusing her. Fila laughed. How foolish she'd been to think she needed that relic of a crown. How foolish to grieve for Samney. How foolish to desire the company of her weak, flesh-bound sister. She blinked. Black. Blinked and saw the final familiar curve of the stairs just above her. The walls of the spiral stairwell were cracked. Red dust sifted down from those fissures and fell like snow upon the steps. The blood spire swayed and she careened into the wall, pressed her palm out to stop herself and sliced the skin open. Only light came from that wound. And Fila laughed as she let the swaying momentum carry her the last 10 steps to the door, which hung open already, the frame shattered by the twisting of the architecture around it. In the windswept rain with the spire shuddering, Queen Fila wheeled across the balcony to the cracked stone railing. Whole sections had broken off and slipped away, but she leaned against a portion that seemed to have withstood it all. Out across the storm-dark hills, whole areas stood intact, somehow untouched. But they were the exception. Every last bridge had fallen. The hills of the 5 great clans were scarred with wide new ravines, the wreckage of houses, and fires so hungry even the rain could not douse them. With the storm raging, it was impossible to see the full grandeur of Quandis now. Even from the balcony of the blood spire,
so Fila could not know how far the damage ranged any better than she could guess how long the ground would continue to roar. Were the seas themselves shaking? Had the islands of the ring begun to tear themselves apart and float away? Sorrow twined with joy inside her. Thousands of her people had died, were dying now, rattling their last breaths or being crushed beneath rubble as towers collapsed, or the earth itself swallowed them. They did not need a queen, not now. They needed a god, but that was okay. She would be that god. She spread her arms wide, though her left fist had withered to a gnarled claw, and she laughed. How they would love her now. How they would worship her, Queen Fila. The god, Fila, cried out the names of the four who were her kin, cried out for Daphine and Batika, Ansalam and Charin. She could feel them now in their tombs, could feel the seething power there and the way it flowed up through her and back down again, connecting them forever. With prayers not to them but to herself, urging herself on, she reached out as if to grasp the storm in her own hands, reached down as if to twist the rock and dirt beneath the streets, to wield it all. The song in her bones reached a pitch inside her skull that made her open her mouth and scream with such ferocity that it shredded her throat to silence. She felt her bones twist and crack, felt her rib cage shatter, and staggered forward to catch herself on the railing. The wind seemed to hesitate, the trembling to pause, and then it all roared back as if she'd never touched it, as if she had never communed with the gods, as if she had no magic at all. Fila glanced down, saw that she'd landed on one knee. Bones had torn through her chest and her thigh, stabbing so sharply that they'd ripped through clothing as well. She could no longer feel them. The sight made no sense to her. The storm made no sense, nor did the loss. With that gnarled hand, she reached painfully to touch her head. Sure, the crown should be resting there. A strange, impossible silence enveloped her, and she thought she heard, as if from a great distance, the sweet, innocent laughter of her little sister. Fila wondered if she herself had ever laughed like that. She wished that she could remember. She glanced out across a city tearing itself apart, and she thought, at last, that perhaps the magic of the gods had not been a gift, but a curse, an infection, and never truly hers. A crack resounded across the sky, a sound like the world breaking, but it was only the blood spire as it splintered and began to fall. Fila tried to hold on to the railing, but she slid and tumbled as the spire broke and toppled. For the second time, Queen Fila felt as if she must be flying. She kept hoping for the blackness to return, but she remained awake and aware all the way down. In the presence of gods, the rest of the world fell silent. Blaine did not understand how he could have fallen so far. There was no passage of time in his perception from launching his final attack upon Fila in the temple's courtyard to opening his eyes down here. Yet he must have fallen so far down and then risen from the rubble, descended farther, through tunnels and caverns and underground spaces, and to this place, where his whole life had been leading him. And he was not the only one. He saw movement to his left, two shadows emerging from the dark mouth of a tunnel. One of them was Jemmy, caked in mud and blood and coming for him. Standing in the cavern of the tombs, he felt distant from everyone else. Blaine blinked dust and water from his eyes and felt a surge of something dragging him almost physically across the cavern floor. He crawled, scrabbling like a huge spider, his limbs acting of their own accord to carry him toward the tombs.
Blaine,
a weak voice said. And it was Jemmy calling him back. To help her, maybe. Or to draw him away from the tombs. He didn't heed it. He couldn't. No one would hold him back now. This was everything he wanted, and had always wanted. Jemmy should know that, and if he had time, he'd have paused to tell her. This is the beginning of the Bajuman Age. He didn't want to risk not completing what he had begun. Too many people depended on him, and he felt a stab of pain and guilt for every Bajuman who had died today. If he'd worked harder at gaining this magic, if he had believed some more. He splashed across the spreading and deepening pool of water, and toward the tombs of four gods he had never believed in. He couldn't doubt them now. Now, with the power he had surging inside, and the greater power he had yet to find. And Blaine felt suddenly good. Gone were the pains in his gut and chest, and the terrible throbbing inside his head as if his brain were about to burst. He still bled from countless wounds, but they were from his long fall, not from damage wrought by the magic. He felt ready to wield it again, only 1,000 times more effective. No longer a man, he was ready to wield magic like a god, ready to be the savior for whom the Bajuman had waited so long, ready to be the Kijtal. Blaine, a voice called again. He paused, stood in the waist-high water, and looked back toward the cavern wall. Jemmy stood there, nursing a broken arm and staring after him, her expression hidden by dust and distance. But the voice was not hers.
Blaine, you must not.
Persantiger was staggering toward him. The old priest's robes had been ripped off in the fall, and his dark, leathery skin was torn and ridged with caked dust. He was a strange old creature, and Blaine grinned. How he had survived the long fall was a mystery that only magic could explain.
You're wrong, Blaine said. I must. You'll see. They're calling me. They know and welcome me, and they're calling me. You saw what it did to the queen, and her mother before her.
It drove them mad, Blaine thought. But he did not feel mad. He looked down at his hands, and they were not the hands of a madman. He leaned over, still, and looked at his reflection in the water. Stirred by movement, if that was the face of a madman staring back, he could not see it well enough to know. He turned and splashed toward the tombs, passing through the water curtain that still fell, entering their space, and he didn't stop until he had climbed the dais and stood among them. The four tombs lay around him, east and west, north and south, their positions dictating the orientation of the great towers that had been built way above in their honor. He had never been this close. He had come no closer than the pool surrounding the tombs, but now, his place felt up here among them, standing like a god, while they lay down like the dead things they were. He craved to absorb everything they had left to give. He turned slowly, looking from tomb to tomb, willing them to give up whatever of them remained. He muttered words and phrases he'd heard Fila and her high order say, but nothing happened. He opened himself up to them, ripping at his clothing until he was naked, standing with arms held wide and soul open and willing. But still nothing happened. He felt the powers he already had surging within him, caressing now instead of hurting. But he wanted so much more. He wanted it all.
Blaine, please,
Persantiger said. The old priest was hobbling toward him through the deepening water, and Jemmy was holding his arm, helping him on his way. Blaine blinked, and a heavy thud sounded through the cavern, sending a series of high waves out from the tombs. Jemmy and Persantiger went down beneath the first wave, coughing and spluttering as they stood again, wiping their eyes, spitting water from their mouths.
The river ran close by, outside this cavern, but Fila's ambition had cracked the world and now the river was coming in. From around him, Blaine heard a low shuffling sound, like something moving against rock. He glanced at the mass of fallen rock that had tumbled down from way above, and several large boulders lifted from their resting place and clashed together, smashing into fragments. That shifting sound came again, and this time Blaine was ready for it, kneeling with his head cocked so that he could make out where it came from. It came from all around. He moved closer to one of the tombs. It was coffin-shaped, but larger, carved roughly and displaying no signs of seams or cracks. Whatever it contained was meant to be sealed inside forever. He hesitated for a moment, then laid his hands on the stone. It was cold, rough, lifeless. He shouted, sending a shockwave around the cavern that splashed aside the water curtain that always fell, and he felt movement beneath his hands, transmitted from inside the stone coffin. His heart hammered, his skin tingled, his senses burned, alive and alert and ready for more. "I will be the eternal god," Blaine thought. He took a step back and looked around, jumped down into the lake, plunged his hand beneath the surface, grabbed a broken block the size of his head and climbed back up.
"Blaine, please, you don't know what you're doing," Jemmy said from behind him.
Blaine ignored her. She was nothing. None of them were anything. And they would soon see that he was everything. He was the Kij Tal whose birth had been prophesied. His people would rise with him as their leader and take what should always have been theirs. Quandis would burn, and from the flames would rise a greater place, a Bajuman place. He lifted the block in both hands and smashed it down onto the tomb. It only took one strike. Stone cracked and fell away. The block smashed into fragments, and he closed his eyes for an instant against the shards. "Maybe I should never open them again," he thought. He opened them anyway, and screamed. Daria went down, as an admiral, as a Bajuman, as a sister. She had no choice but to follow her brother into the depths revealed beneath Temple Hill. She left Lieutenant Skin in overall command until Mirren could appoint a new commander of the force that would become the new city guard. While Skin and the surviving rebels retreated through the remains of the temple to secure the area, Daria found a rope and started lowering herself into the pit. She knew that whatever lay below was nothing natural. Or perhaps it was the most natural thing in the world. The first thing. But it was strange and new to her. She could feel it on the air and smell it, and the sense of some vast thing waiting below with bated breath was almost enough to drive her back up, running from the temple and back through the ruined city to her ship. It was the sister in her that drove her on. She had spent so long without Blaine, and every part of her now needed to know what had happened to him. "Nothing good," she thought. "Nothing good can come of this." Deep down was the hope that she would find him dead. But she tried to bury that thought, afraid that if he was still alive, he might hear it. The long rope ended before the bottom of the hole, and she had to climb the wall the rest of the way down. Rocks tumbled away beneath her. Creatures watched from holes in the pit wall, breathing, wafting noxious breath in her direction. And she was always prepared to draw her sword and defend herself against whatever strange things might come at her. But nothing came. It was as if these subterranean beasts knew that greater things were happening. At the bottom, she scrambled over piles of loose rubble, ran through tunnels, always deeper, always somehow confident that she was going the right way. Something drew her on. Something terrible.
"Blaine,"
she heard at last, a woman's voice, and then soon after an old man called his name as well. Daria climbed down another steep slope. Some light emerged from somewhere, and she could just make out the lake at the slope's bottom. The survivors gave her hope, but hearing them call Blaine's name frightened her too. She'd seen what he could do, and what Fila had already done. The city and its people had already sustained too much damage, and perhaps it was mortally wounded, both as a place and a concept. Perhaps the